Thank you, Claire, for answering some questions. I imagine most of us have read Nick's memoir or will be reading it soon, and the first question I want to ask you is, what did he get wrong? What do you remember differently?
This is serious. My mother's maiden name was Stewart, spelled the French way, and he misspelled it.
Uh-oh. That's big.
Inexcusable. Because my mother's forebears came from St. Andrews, Scotland, where we lived for a time.
Let the record show.
So, but that's the only thing that
okay.
And that's incident.
Are there things he left out of the memoir that you wish he had included?
I don't think so. But of course his perceptions were different from mine because of the role that males, men, play in denominational life. And COS began while a lot of denominations did not ordain women, and men took all the prominent roles and the lesser roles besides. So, no, I think it reflects that period of time, which was a rich and varied time.
What are some of your strongest memories about the formation of the Fellowship of the Acts, or Church of the Servant, as it became later?
Well, we met together on every other Saturday, and we wrote little liturgies. But I should go backward a little bit. The denomination created a committee to study the history of worship. Now I think they would call it liturgy, I'm not sure. And Nick was one of, I don't know how many people on that committee, and he opened his eyes. So he studied Christian worship from the very beginnings, from the first century. And that was rich and wonderful. And he began teaching it at Calvin, I guess, during interim. And it opened up a whole new world, and we talked together with people, some you know, who taught at Calvin and who were involved in the Christian Reformed Church in various ways. One was a minister. We did Bible study, and we began asking all kinds of provocative questions of each other. And that was quite wonderful. And out of that came a group that made these liturgies. We shared a common meal. We stood around a dining room table and we wrote little things. And for me and for Nick, another source was the Tezzang community, which we had visited. And we saw a very healthy group of men who lived a committed life, who were very beautifully led, and who had households. That's where we get the name.
From the Tezzang community,
The Tezzang. And Nick and I had visited there, and Nick had asked questions about their liturgy and their worship and everything about the common life. And so that was a source, a wonderful source. And at one time later, very few people know this, some of the brothers visited Synod.
Really?
Yes. And we've been in touch with them pretty much ever since.
Was there any Tezzang-style worship in Grand Rapids at that point?
Or no, there is now.
Yes.
There is now.
Right.
No. And later on, you know, we've lived many places, or a number of places in New Haven and in Oxford, England. There were regular Tezzang services early in the morning or late at night where people gathered.
Yeah. So it wasn't just the style of worship, but the whole life.
Yes, a communal life.
Which suggests that households are pretty central to at least the initial vision of Church of the Servant.
Yes.
Were there other distinctive opportunities that this group, I'm never sure whether to call it, at what point did the Fellowship of the Acts become Church of the Servant?
Well, it was often referred to as the Underground Church. Probably have heard that, but Fellowship of the Acts, the first public worship we had was downtown in one of the wives, and I can remember Marty Meenstra standing on the sidewalk and saying, this is just like getting married. This is, you know, exciting.
Oh, my, yeah.
I'll never forget that.
Wow. So did COS fill some gaps or alleviate some concerns in your faith life and worship experiences?
Yeah. Because now I'm going to be personal. I grew up in the East Coast, and there were the Seven Sisters, which were women's only colleges. And I admired them, and I knew about them, and I had the opportunity to go to Vassar. And there I had a religion professor who became very famous, and he wanted to go to church, and he chose an Episcopal church. And so I had been introduced, and I was one of the students that he took on Sunday mornings. And I was one of the students that went to the Episcopal church with him, and I was taken under the wing of that rector. And so that was my introduction to a more formal liturgical style. And that's one of the reasons that I enjoyed this whole process of the formation of the Church of the Servant.
Yeah.
Became Church of the Servant.
As I understand it, one of the formative ideas in Church of the Servant was that women should have more of a leadership role and that lay people should have more leadership role. That's Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, I was a dear friend of Marty Greenstra, and we each had tiny children.
And I will note that one of those tiny children was Ron Greenstra.
Yeah, right. And we used to talk daily, and it was really about worship and, you know, our lives and as mothers, but as people who were very interested in the church and healthy church life. And I don't know where I'm going with that, but... So Marty was a big part of it, and I remember she went to seminary, and she was not allowed to speak to the powers that be at Synod one year, but she talked privately, and I can remember her coming to our house afterward, and some of the men who heard her said, "We are so sorry we didn't give you a voice."
Wow.
And eventually, of course, she was ordained, and you know, Nola went to seminary, and there were a whole group of people who did. And speaking personally now, then many years later, I established a house of prayer, especially for women. And behind that was the idea that women should have a place where they can speak and interact, and it's safe. And many women who later were ordained. And they're all over North America.
Marty Greenstra was not ordained in the CRC,
no,
am I right?
No,
he was at the RCA?
Presbyterian
Church.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And you were ordained in the Episcopalian Church,
yeah,
correct?
Yeah. By that time I had made my way there.
Tell me about that. Was it had to be frustrating to know that you couldn't do that in your own denomination, but you had some experience.
Well, I tell this story because I grew up in Philadelphia and among Quakers, and I was very conscious of them because during the war they were pacifists. And my father would take me to listen to their discussions about how they would avoid paying taxes that supported the war. Mm-hmm. So that was very vivid to me. And so when people say, you know, how did you get there? You know, later on this was completed by Nick's study and by what happened, you know, in our formation of this church. But I would say, well, you know, Quakers say, are you a convinced Quaker or are you a birthright Quaker? Say, well, I think I was meant to be a birthright Quaker, but God put me in the wrong bassinet. Well, that explains, you know, why I am where I am.
But you didn't become a Quaker?
No,
minister.
I didn't. No. I became.
Was it basically the liturgical tradition of
the Anglican
tradition that drew you?
Okay. Yes, I think.
Where did you go to seminary?
Well, I went to Western Seminary for a year, which has welcomed many Christian Reformed people who have later become priests. Mm-hmm. And Mary Frances Deer and was involved in Elizabeth House, and I can name more names. And I have friends among the clergy who are retired Presbyterian mm-hmm. ministers and, you know, all over. And it's a rich, wonderful group of a sisterhood, I guess. And for a time, I don't know whether Marty started this or not, but there were 50, just this is an aside, but this is significant. At a certain point, the women who were ordained in Western Michigan got together on a regular basis, and we had jokes and, you know, gatherings that were very nourishing. And I think it can't be that there are that many, but there were maybe as many as 50. Anyways, it was a sizable group of women who were ordained, and it was, you know, many denominations.
And for those who don't know, that did not include the CRC until, was it 1996?
I should know when.
Mid-90s, anyway.
Another aside, I'm sure we already had this building. And when I was in seminary at Seabury, this was in Evanston, where I finished my training, ordination of women in the Episcopal Church was being celebrated, and it was very difficult for them to do that. And I think I quoted Alan Busack, I'm sure I did, and I don't know what I quoted. I said, we have to celebrate this. This mm-hmm. is important. And so the same thing later, years later here, we celebrated the ordination of women at COS. Mm-hmm. So I think COS has been a safe place, an encouraging place, it has done much for the ordination of women and for their acceptance and their and you know, and their esteem. Yeah, and I think it's wonderful.
I do too. Have there been important differences between your understanding of Reformed theology or practice and Anglican theology and practice? Has one shaped the other in some ways, or shaped your understanding of the other?
Well, let's start out with my Episcopal experience. I have four passages from the Bible. You have a psalm, you have a Hebrew passage, you have an epistle from the New Testament, and you have a gospel. And at the time that I became an Episcopalian, I have to say, sadly, preaching was not as fine as it is now. It has improved vastly. But I would be very nourished in church on a Sunday morning by those passages.
By hearing
that, I would bring that home. And I mention that because now that's true here. More and more, we have the tradition of following that. And what I love about it is what I mentioned, that there will often be conversations between two passages.
Right.
And I'll give you an example that happened in the Netherlands, and it was quite by accident, but our son Eric died on the 11th of June, and we were at the Westerkerk on the Sunday in which the lectionary passages spoke of the widow in the Old Testament whose son was raised, and the widow in the New Testament her son was raised by Jesus, and our friend Nico happened to preach on that. That's the most wonderful confluence of the lectionary that mm-hmm. I've ever experienced, and that happens now at COS, and I still read the lections every Sunday morning or Saturday night so that I usually know what's coming, and I find a richness there, a scriptural richness that I just cherish. So, you know, it isn't so much doctrinal, it's experiential,
right.
Because people's lives are being discussed, you know,
yes.
And I find a richness there that just purely doctrinal stuff may not have.
Tell me about some of your roles as an Episcopal priest. You've been a spiritual director.
Yes, I still am. Mm-hmm. Well, that happened. And when a person is ordained in the Episcopal Church, there's a celebration and for the ordination, and there's a collection taken, and that's a purse which is given to the ordinand. And I immediately went off to Notre Dame because I wanted to learn more about spiritual direction. Mm-hmm. And so I took a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful course in spiritual direction, and that got me started. I had the sense... Well, I said that was my call, and I haven't mentioned this, but when I and Marty and a group of women, it was an ecumenical group of women, a black woman who was Baptist, a lay Catholic woman, a nun, a local nun, and a Jewish rabbi's wife, we all started and nourished Elizabeth House. And that was the place where women who sensed a strong call could just go and be quiet and pray. And we sang a couple of Taizé songs, and we used the Taizé office in the morning, and then somebody living in the house would make tea, and it was wonderful, absolutely wonderful. And when it had to close, three Christian Reformed ministers who spent their days off there did everything to keep it open.
Oh. Tell me about Dayspring.
Dayspring was something else that sort of grew out of the Church of the Servant. Dayspring was started by Don Smulligan and I, and his wife is still living and a member of this church. We managed to buy a huge duplex down on Cherry Street, and we decided that it would be important to have a place where young adults, post-college or in college, could do things cooperatively, and it was in existence for some years, and other people at COS have been involved and have lived there, and it was formed during the time that we sponsored our first refugees, because I remember the Vietnamese family had some association with it. But the wonderful thing was, Claudia Beversluis was involved, and I forget who all else, one of the things we did there, I was in touch with a Roman Catholic woman who, she was involved with a ministry that took unmarried pregnant teenagers. And we decided that we would invite them to cook and make a meal once a week at Dayspring. And it was wonderful because they sat down and we set a table and we talked about good food. And that was wonderful.
So that's related to COS too. What have been some of the biggest surprises about what COS has become over the years, for good or for ill?
Well, you know, we were very idealistic and very naive. And we weren't going to own a church, of course not.
Right. Never have a building, never get bigger than
100. Nick says, I saw 50 properties. I don't know. Well, anyway, I saw a lot. Former, you know, grocery stores. What do you do with a flat roof like that? And redundant churches, and so on and so on. And nothing showed up. We rented schools, as many people know, and there would be no nursery, of course. So we'd have to use a classroom, we'd have to set up everything, we'd have to take it down, and we had a lot of artists in the group, and from the very beginning, that's one of the wonderful things about COS, the artists, Wolf Banners, and Hilda Wilson made Batik, and I'll never forget her wonderful banner, and I had a something for Pentecost, which is no more, and also something for Lent, which was stolen from Elizabeth House and never recovered, and so forth. But anyway, so that developed alongside the word part.
Yes.
was the representative part. Another thing, I don't know that this is an answer to the question you asked. I'm sort of ranging around, but the circle, people coming forward, the notion, and making a circle and standing and giving the bread and the wine to each other. I don't know anywhere else that's that done.
I love that.
And this is another aside that has to do with Eric. Jack had been here for 2 or 3 weeks, and Eric died. And I'll never forget Jan Pott and Jack came to our home. And so that was one of the first things he had to do. And there again, Nick and my closeness to the rabbi then, Philip Siegel, was such that it was an ecumenical service, the funeral. And it was held at Calvin Church. We couldn't make a circle in the usual way there, but we had people coming forward in some sort of circle. And Philip Siegel said to us after, I asked him, I said, you choose a passage from the Hebrew Testament and read it in Hebrew and read your translation, which he did. And afterward he said to us, I wished I could have been in the circle.
Oh my.
And he was a New Testament scholar. And he wanted very much to teach in a Christian seminary.
Goodness.
So that was rich.
Yes.
I'm remembering all these things, you know, in anticipation.
Was the circle part of the group from the very beginning? Was that?
I don't really remember, but I think closely on. Yeah, yeah. But art was always part, and I don't think we followed the lectionary then. I don't know when we adopted that, but that is one of the very important things for me, because that was one of the attractions of the Episcopal Church and the Roman Catholic Church. I prepare a sermon nowadays, and Presbyterian, Roman Catholic, Lutheran, you name it, they're reflecting on the same passages of Scripture, and that's wonderful, and that it happens here too is wonderful to me.
Any other surprises about COS over the years?
Oh, well, I think our God nudged us with a sense of humor over our naivete and our and all that. We were not going to grow bigger, so big that we would need a mic. We were going to have a sister church. And now the aside to that is there were members at we grew quite large, and we did need a mic, and we needed a substantial space. And there was a group that wanted to start a sister church, And I felt so strongly that group should be supported in its conversation, in its reflection, in its prayer, that I joined that group. I didn't, you know, I wanted to support them in every way possible, because if that were a good thing, I wanted to bless it. And a few people left, but some of those people that were part of that discussion, which was healthy and went on for a good while, mm-hmm. are still here. So I think that's another one of the things that maybe some people don't know. Yeah.
So did a sister church emerge, or
I think maybe they found their way to a smaller Christian Reformed church. Because we had grown, you know, we thought we were just doing this little thing in a corner. Because we were nudged by God, and we followed that.
So growth was never the goal?
No!
God's funny that way.
No, that we would, that we could continue to be a vibrant community.
Right, yeah. Right. Mm-hmm. I'll shift gears and go a little broader now. You've balanced several roles as mother and wife and priest and artist and I don't know what else. How have those roles complemented each other, and have they come into conflict at times?
Not sure I know how to answer that. You know, as one of four daughters, I have an older brother. We're all still alive, so getting on. My mother spoke very succinctly, but with few words, but I had the sense that all along that she had a sense of self which she imbued in us, which probably I've carried with me ever since, and that illuminated or whatever infused my joy in COS.
Because it gave you
Because I was involved in many roles, but I took joy in all the women that were coming up and that were being affirmed. It was just marvelous to be living through that.
So that affirmed, so COS's way of doing things affirmed what you knew to be
but
it
had come first from my family.
Yeah.
And my father's affirmation too.
That's a real gift.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You're known too for your gift of hospitality, and I'm wondering where that came from. What were you taught about that?
I don't know, because I grew up in a very isolated circumstance in Philadelphia. No relatives. I mean, I saw my mother's mother once in my life. Mm-hmm. And
did that make you more likely to reach out to others to make friends?
I don't know. I don't know that we're terribly hospitable, but we enjoy people, and we've enjoyed the variety of people that have been attracted to COS and beyond. Nick and I were members of a dinner club that had two Roman Catholic couples and two Episcopal couples, and this half and half one, Nick and I.
Yeah.
And it was the richness of, they were all people of faith, very vibrant faith. So, yeah, and I didn't grow up in a Dutch community. In fact, my first experience in a Dutch community was, oh, really? I'm not sure I like my tribe.
Was that college, or was that...
No, I came here in high school, but when I got by the time I got to Calvin, I just thought, oh, Calvin is wonderful. And know this, but when Nick and I married, I thought I'd end up a minister's wife in Iowa. It wasn't altogether likely, because he was pre-sem. But my love for him and my security in him was very solid and very healthy. And, you know, he's always been open and so hospitable and welcoming. We enjoy a variety of people. We both of us always have.
Tell me about your first impressions of Nick Walthersdorf. He got to write about it, so you tell us your side.
He says we met in the Chimes office. Yes, but I was sort of introduced to Nick by Ed Bovee. In fact, I dated Ed before I dated Nick, and these three young men didn't have a car. One of them did. And so we were sort of six people, varying. And so Ed and Irvine have been lifelong friends since we've been adults. He just died, and I'm still very much grieving that, so is Nick.
He and his wife were both art professors for a long time.
Well, she introduced drama. She introduced theater.
Okay.
Calvin would not be the school it is without either of them. And Ed felt welcomed and accepted and understood by my parents. My mother was an artist. My father loved art. Ed and my father were both graduate students at U of M together. My father studying history of art, and Ed, whatever, he got an MA there. And so that's what I remember, those early times, which were very, very rich.
Tell me more about young Nick.
Young Nick? Well, I have to say, once I was introduced to his family and his extended family, his mother died when he was 3 and a half, you know, and leaving 4 babies, 2, 3 and a half, and 2 newborns. But his father later married again, and so he was brought up by a woman who was the eldest or second eldest of 10. And so that's an extended family that has been enriched our lives beyond belief, and I treasure them. So that's a side of Nick that's really wonderful for me, and being introduced to that on Sunday mornings, the discussions and disagreements, but we always kissed each other, and, you know, and the extended care, which is still precious to us, all the ones, you know. So that's what I was introduced. I hadn't experienced that. My nearest relatives were 90 miles away.
Sure.
And when we married, my parents were soon at Westmont, and we rarely saw my parents.
So you married a whole family. So
I married a whole family, and I'm delighted by it. Good. Absolutely delighted by it.
What would people who know Nick today but didn't know him back then be surprised by?
I don't know. I can't put myself out of.
You're just
I can't put myself out of, you know, out of context of my initial reactions to him. I can't say, well, that's how they thought of it.
Well, tell me about your initial reactions.
Well, he's a steady person, and he's healthy, psychologically and spiritually very healthy. And I had seen all kinds of permutations, you know, in churches and among my parents, friends in Philadelphia and so forth, people who were troubled and struggling. But so here was Nick, and open to all kinds of experiences, and not troubled by that, and joyous about them. And I think that's what attracted him to me and me to him. That I thought I can live in Iowa with this person.
Would still be an adventure.
And be happy. And I would have been.
Well, I'm glad you're here. Would you talk some about your love for art, particularly textiles? So we have a lot of banners and stoles and so forth that
you've
made here.
I've been insisting on it.
What draws you to art, and what draws you specifically to textiles?
Well, I don't have the love for plants my parents did, but I was steeped in art from before I was born. And I'm not an artist, I'm a crafts person, but I've always liked textures and colors. My mother was a wonderful colorist, and she had a wonderful design gift. And as a little child, we went with our father to the Philadelphia Art Museum. And it was a familiar and lovely place, and on Saturdays they had art films that were unbelievably wonderful. And my brother, strange saying this now, he was interested in guns, but I don't remember him ever going out hunting. What I remember is the many hours I spent watching him make inlaid gun stock by the hour. So I was always, and my parents were both gardeners, and they would ooh and ah over their plants, and I was surrounded by that. So I didn't know what it meant not to enjoy art.
Now, you say you're not a gardener, but you have quite a lot of hostas, right?
Well, that's Nick. Those are Nick's. Yeah, I'm not a gardener.
All right.
But I enjoy very much so.
You and Nick seem to share a love for art, not as it's presented in an exhibition, but as it's lived with daily.
Mm-hmm. We inadvertently became collectors. And I'm thinking of a woman I knew from the church in somewhere, was saying of her little kid, certain actions, once was a habit. So I think once was a habit for us. Once we, there was a group that started that wanted, you know, the difference between an original print, something that's made, and then a photo reproduction. And they decided that people of no means or small means should have a chance to own original art. And so they started the International Graphic Arts Society. And so then we became collectors. And one thing led to another. Then we read something in the New York Times about Japanese ceramics. And I had briefly potted. My brother is a potter. And once was a habit there too. You know, we have beautiful pots. And one thing led to another. And I was very interested in weaving. And so wherever we move in the next little while, there has to be space for my spinning wheels.
Yes.
So color and texture. I've always sewn my own clothes, still do. And so I got the love of color from my mother and the love of design. I'm used to, it's just part of my life. I love to read too, and my mother's studio was on the third floor, and our bedroom was down below, and she would, and every so often turn the light out and stop reading.
Yes.
So that was, you know, her studio was filled with...
Do you have a few favorite books or authors that you want to mention?
Well, I've been very nourished by the prayer books of Jim Cotter, who was an Anglican priest. And I never met him, but I felt very close to him, and he was my spiritual director. And another person whom I never met, but I heard preach, was Anthony Bloom, who was Russian in origin, but he grew up speaking French, and he became a medical doctor. He's written lovely little books about prayer and, you know, the ways of prayer. Brother Lawrence, you know, the practice of the presence of God, these are precious to me, and I, you know, they nourish me. And I could go on, but those are the three that you know, when I did spiritual direction, I would say, well, these are nourishing to me, and I think you could begin there, and with the Psalms, of course.
People, I've heard people talk about your public prayers. There are a few people, I feel like when God sees Jane Zwart's names in the bulletin, he gets happy. You know,
oh, yes, no, I agree, yeah, I agree,
her, right?
Absolutely.
And people have said essentially the same thing about your prayers, that they're quite genuine, that they're never performative or formulaic. So how do you think about prayer?
Well,
and public prayer.
Public prayer. It's very important to speak to the human condition, not just in Grand Rapids or Michigan or the U.S., but the suffering elsewhere. So I try to address that and give thanks for this vibrant community that I love so much. And I was ordained in this and am associated till now in the St. Philip's of Black Church, which is very precious to me and I to them. So in prayer as in preaching, I try to make a living relationship with God and interaction with God visible, well, not visible, but present in words. My father loved language. And so I'm careful about words, and I try to use words that are evocative and will help a person follow the petitions. But also, I began writing prayer books in the early 90s when Nick was losing a Ken Kanondak to cancer. And I thought, I didn't have words after Eric died. And when you're facing death, you need to be given words.
Mm-hmm.
So I began writing prayer books, and I do to this day. And so I pay very close attention to the kinds of petitions, and I want the language to be clear and as simple as possible, and as straightforward as possible. I want God to be addressed. I addressed when I did intercessory prayers here, I would address God as Holy One, because I find that many women find it very difficult to hear he over and over again. You know, supposedly Sophia was present at the creation too. Now, Sophia is a feminine name for the Holy Spirit.
Right.
I want women to feel that they are addressing God when I pray. Mm-hmm. So that I work very hard at that.
What's your biggest hope for Church of the Servant in the coming years?
That the Church of the Servant continue to listen sensitively without offering a rebuttal. And I think we do that quite well. And what I'm treasuring now is the regular meetings. I couldn't go Wednesday talking about sexualities. Mm-hmm. And I think few congregations in the Christian Reformed Church or anywhere can do that so gently and encouragingly. I hope that the Church of the Servant continues that, because that's part of the whole piece, part of welcoming women, part of welcoming people of different Christian traditions, certainly different ethnicities mm-hmm. and colors. I love it.
Just to listen.
All of that. Yeah. All of that, it seems to me. Yeah. So I hope we're faithful to that tradition. Traditions can be wonderful, and they don't need to be stifling. They can open up breadth.
Thank you very much, Claire, for your time. And if you would like to learn more about any of these topics, you should read In This World of Wonders or talk with Claire and Nick. Thank you.
I'm Karen Salpe, and this has been a conversation with Claire Waltersdorf at Church of the Servant in Grand Rapids, Michigan on June 15th, 2019.